period three. Behind Let Loose. This is our third week, and we're up to period three. Last time we talked about periods one and two in the history of the Church of Scotland. Those sections were smaller. This one, however, period three, containing the testimony of the Reformation from popery. This is a much more extensive chapter, a much more extensive look at history, for a couple of reasons. One is it represents a Reformation that, as we're going to see, is a reclaiming of the church from anti-Christian tyranny to what Shields will call a primitive or pristine condition or state, much like the Apostolic Church. We're going to talk about a number of things that reflect upon that idea. We're going to go through a number of points that he lists, and one of the more interesting things in this section are, in particular, a bunch of quotes that he pulls from John Knox. So we're going to have to think about Knox a bit. Now remember, Knox, who's looked at as the great reformer of Scotland, was a disciple of Calvin to some extent. He had been to Geneva and studied there. So by appealing to Knox, there is an idea that what Knox is doing is very much like what other reformers are doing in other countries. Okay, the agenda is very similar. They're trying to break the bondage of popery, and that has ramifications both in church and state. So if you remember, in period two, we talked about the suffering of the church, the testimony bearing that was going on, and Shields tells us that the testimony bearing was mainly by way of suffering. There wasn't a lot that could be done, and the period of time he's talking about, period two, was that period of decline in the Church of Scotland in particular that eventually leads to it being placed under the bondage of the Roman Church. During that period of time, the testimony was by way of suffering. If you disagreed, if you resisted, you're going to suffer. In fact, not only would you suffer, you might suffer in a lesser sense. Plenty of people died. So up to question 46, and we're beginning this period, this testimony concerning the Reformation from popery, that period. In contrast to the former period, our author has outlined, how is the testimony of this period executed? Shields says, in the former period, it's passive, mostly passive. But in this period, now that we're talking about the Reformation from popery, The testimony is active. And question 47, for what causes was the testimony carried on during this period? The causes, he says, are twofold. Religion and liberty. And what he means by that is it's a testimony that has bearing on the church or ecclesiastical state of the nation of Scotland, as well as the civil organization of the nation of Scotland. All right, question 48. Wherein does the shame and stupidity of the generation to whom Shields was writing appear? And he's talking about what he calls the shameful security and ass-like stupidity of the present generation. He's talking about the people in 1687. So I know people think that sometimes things are said that are harsh. Remember, Shields thought that these people were overcome with an ass-like stupidity. But he says that the shame and stupidity was in this. They had been entrusted with the testimony through the witnessings and wrestlings of their worthy ancestors. But now they're letting it slip between their feeble fingers. Okay, they're allowing this testimony that has been, in a sense, bought and paid for by the previous generations. They're letting that go. Now, I want you to remember what he's talking about here is his generation in 1687. He's calling attention to what we're about to discuss. The testimony from the period of Reformation from popery. So he's saying, look, this is, as we're going to see, something for which these people not only contended, but suffered and died. And at the time of the Reformation from popery, they're not leaving us merely this passive testimony. They have actively engaged to testify against the anti-Christian spirit that's come into the church, and that is what he's saying. You're allowing it to slip away. With each day, we get farther and farther away from the things for which they contended. Now, he begins by bringing up the issue of the Queen Dowager Regent, who he says reigned by the curse of God. This is an important thing. This kind of language. This goes back to what he has to say in earlier ages. Remember the cataloging of the defenestration of various kings from time to time. Does anybody know what that word defenestration means? Since I've used it.
Deposing?
Huh? What's
that? Get thrown out of a window?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means, getting thrown out of a window. That and that is actually what happens to a couple of these guys in the past. Right? They're literally like thrown over the wall or thrown out of the castle, what have you. Okay, when the Scots wanted to get rid of these tyrants, they were decisive in their action. So the Queen Dowager Regent is... She's regent because she's reigning instead of the king, the rightful heir. She's a dowager, which means that she is basically the widow from the previous king. This is talking about James the sixth, James the first of Great Britain, his mother. Okay, she reigned by the curse of God, and she employed all her power and policy to suppress the gospel in Scotland. This is at the beginning of the Reformation. We're talking about a period of time just prior to 1560. All right, or right around 1560. This is just prior to James assuming the throne, although he can't, in his minority, there are regents appointed. But anyway, she is the one in this interregnum between the Jameses. And she is using her power and her place in society to bear down. Now, the reason she's doing this is she is a member of the family of Guise. They were French and they were papists. So if you ever wondered why the French keep showing up on the shores of Scotland during these contentions early on, if you read histories, you'll hear that the French are showing up. It's because of this connection. Right? They want to restore Scotland to fealty to the Pope. And every time they get an invitation, any time they have what looks like an opening, for most of the latter part of the 1500s, The French will try to insinuate themselves into the political structure of Scotland. All right, question 49. What maxim of the early church proved true during the reign of the Queen Dowager? That is, that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Now that saying is very early in the church. One of the early fathers noted that. So very early on, someone observed this idea. And it proved true here. The fact is, to some extent, the Scots were such a contrarian nature that the more they tried to suppress any movement away from Rome, the more other people were moved to join the cause. So when you would think that seeing people being executed, and some of them in fairly brutal ways, that would have put people off from joining the church. Right, they would maybe say, I'll stay a Romanist because it's safe. But it didn't. The church actually grew as a result. So, Question 50, what was the result of this persecution that they had under her? Well, the first thing is, there were doubts. The men began to doubt the corrupt practices of the day. They began to doubt if they could, without sin, give their bodily presence to the Mass or offer their children to papistical baptism and so on. It started to raise questions in their minds. The second thing that he notes is that from these doubts, they came to determinations. And they got room there for you to mark down three things. But these are determinations to reform. And there are three things in particular that he mentions that they desired or determined to reform. The first was the preaching of the gospel. The second, the administration of the sacraments. And the third, that the worship, discipline, and government of the church should itself be reformed, the order of the church, the discipline and order of the church.
Is this where when the first book of discipline comes into play?
Not yet.
Not yet.
It comes out of this.
Okay.
We're not quite there yet. We're in the 1550s, probably. All right, the third thing that is noted is this. In order to prosecute the Reformation more effectually, they began to covenant. Now, at this point, he mentions two things in particular that are the subject of them covenanting. The first is they covenant to maintain and advance the work of Reformation. And then the second, that little b, the lowercase b, is to stand to the defense of that Reformation and one another. The covenants, and he begins to talk about this idea of covenanting, and then, I don't know if you remember, but he did point out that this is not something that they just started at the First Reformation. This is something that there'd been a history of doing this in Scotland. And he gave a couple of other examples early on. But now, you have a number of these covenants or bans, as they were called. So in Edinburgh in 1557, Perth 1559, Stirling 1559, Leith 1560, Ayr 1562, and frankly, he could have listed quite a few more. There's a book by a man named Lumsden on the covenants of Scotland that chronicle one after another of these covenants that were made at this time. Some took in more, some less people, but they're doing the same thing. They're looking for this Reformation and what they're interested in. Yeah.
Did they all have the same confession? Like, was it Or was it just like a general Protestant?
They're not. Kind of... In 1560, they'll have the same confession. We're going to get there.
Okay. But they're basically here just commenting to pursue Reformation.
They're Protestant.
Okay.
And they want reform. So they want to see a real reform.
So they're not really binding themselves to a specific set of standards, but they're binding themselves to pursue reform?
Reform.
Okay. Which what leads up to the first covenant, right?
The covenant. First, well, we're not even going to get that far, okay. Really.
But a lot, you know, in the next...
they're going to covenant, and they'll continue to covenant until they have accomplished all the things that we think of as the first Reformation. And roughly speaking, just so you know, when we talk about the first Reformation, the golden year that we're talking about there is 1560. Okay, that's really kind of right at the center, and you'll see why in a few minutes. Okay, 51. By the worship, discipline, government of the church, what, according to Shields, is displayed again the eyes and knowledge of men. And this is important. He says it's the reverend face of the first primitive and apostolic church. In other words, by getting rid of all this other junk and they're going to get to a point in Scotland where they will say of the Reformation that because of it there was nothing of which they were aware that they had retained from the man of sin. Okay, all the usages, everything that they did, they were going back to the primitive church. And they were going back, when I say the primitive church, we're talking about the New Testament church, but we're also talking about returning to certain ideals that had been common in the early early post-apostolic church. A lot of, especially when we talk about worship and discipline, they're going to be very quick to try to mimic that discipline and the simplicity of that earliest worship. All right, 52. What were the two effects of the various covenants enumerated by our author? That is, those covenants that I mentioned in 1557, 59, 60, 62. The first effect was to make them more firm among themselves. Right, their conjunction together was more firm. And that meant that they were creating a stability among themselves. The second thing is, it was to make them more fearful in the eyes of their adversaries. Now, question 53, why did Mr. Shields mention the various acts and effects of covenanting among their forefathers? Why is he so keen to bring that up? Very simple. He wants to vindicate their own practice in imitating them. In other words, he is saying, look, you folks here in 1687 who think that covenanters are singular, unusual, unique. What we're doing when we covenant is nothing different. Our concern for these covenants, nothing different than that concern that very clearly was running through all of our first reformers, including John Knox. Okay, all these guys were doing it, and if you're in the Church of Scotland, shouldn't that be enough to tell you you don't have a prima facie case for dismissing this practice as something unusual or something unbiblical? At least you can't do it unless you're going to take on and I guess condemn somebody of the caliber of Knox. Now, all of this is going on. The Queen Dowager is resisting any kind of reform. But by 1559, they'd had enough. And they're not going to put up with it anymore. So, question 54, for what reasons in 1559 did the Scottish ministers declare the Queen deposed from her reign? Well, they give a list. Now remember, she'd already been persecuted. She, frankly, had been living a lie, you know, in terms of claiming to be some devout papist or whatever. She wasn't even really that. There were issues of idolatry by this time that they had against her. They had charges of immorality. Basically, she had proven herself to be a whore, and it became a matter of public knowledge. So the five reasons that that is listed here, and I think that he probably gets this, although I don't see where off the top of my pages here. I suspect he's getting this either from Knox's history or possibly from Buchanan, but probably from Knox at this point. But anyway, here is what the ministers said. First of all, they're deposing her from all government over them because of her persecution of the professors of true religion. She hates real Christianity. That, from the church's point of view, is a big strike against her, of course. But then there's a second charge of oppressing the liberties of the true lieges, never being called nor convinced of any crime. In other words, she is exercising tyranny. She's taking away liberty from freemen without any indictment, without any proof of crime committed, which is very much contrary to the law, to the fundamental law of the land. So, when we say that the Reformation is about reform in church and state, it really is. They're pointing to all of this. The third thing they point out is her intrusion of magistrates against all order of election. Here again, where the people should have been allowed to appoint, vote for certain officers, she's gone in and she's just appointing whoever she wants. Right. Four. Her bringing in of strangers to suppress the liberty of the country. Do you want to guess who they mean by the bringing in of strangers?
Spanish?
No.
French. Immigration?
Hmm?
Immigration?
French.
The French. Why is it Spanish? Yeah, the French. She's from the House of Guise. They're bringing in the French. And what they're doing literally is this. She is bringing in French troops. And those troops are being turned loose in Scottish villages and towns and cities. And they're enforcing the Queen's order over the protests of the Scots. That, too, is not going over well. And finally, the last reason they cite is her altering and subverting the old laws of the realm. Now that again is a problem. Scotland viewed itself as having a long legal history that in some respects protected the rights of the people more than, say, England. They're not happy. They're not at all happy with what she's doing. They don't want to allow her to continue. So in 1559, they give her the boot. That does not mean that, for example, that James is going to come to power. Not at all. He's not yet in a position to do anything. He's in his minority, and he's really a minor. There are others who were appointed from among the nobility to be regents at that time. And these people will figure quite large in the Reformation. So when they give her the boot, when they kick her out, doesn't mean that this conflict with the French over the reintroduction of popery is over. Not at all. In some respects, it's only begun. But the following year, 1560, is the year, when I say we look at this year as the year of the first Reformation, this is why. There are two important documents framed and adopted in 1560. The first was written by John Knox, and primarily John Knox, the Scottish Confession of Faith. The second was also heavily penned by Knox, and that is the First Book of Discipline. So what they've done is they've laid out and they will ratify that year a Protestant confession and a book of discipline which generally contains the order of presbyterial government. All right, and who adopted these documents? These things were read and they were ratified by the three estates of Parliament. Do you know what the three estates of Parliament would be?
One would be the crown.
What? How does the Parliament composed? You've got the Commons, then you have the House of Lords, and in the House of Lords you have the lords who are landed lords. In a sense, probably leftovers from the feudal system, and then you had the church involved as well.
Is it still that way today?
In England, it was, I think, until recently. I think they've changed some things there. I don't know. I really haven't looked into how the new Scottish Parliament is organized.
I was just wondering, like, in terms of this modern Western idea of, you know, like, separation between church and state, I wasn't sure if they would have gotten rid of the church in Parliament by now, or if it still has, like, kind of role.
Well, I think they have in England, and, you know, the Presbyterians are not happy about that kind of mixture. If they don't, they're going to reject the idea that you can be a civil magistrate and a minister. That you can have both in the same person. They're not happy about that kind of thing. It's confusion. All right, 57. According to Shields, how was the cause of Reformation advanced by this establishment? He lists what I would call three kinds of law. First, positive law. Second, negative law. And third, a punitive law. So the positive law ratifies and confirms the Protestant religion. The negative law abolished anti-Christian popery. And then the punitive law appoints punishments for professors and promoters of popery. Now, the queen had a daughter. The daughter's name was Mary. You may have heard of her. She is known as Mary, Queen of Scots. She returns from France and she returns with this idea that though her mother's been deposed, you know, she will reign over Scotland and that, or she'll have a hand in it. And she takes upon herself, I think, the notion she's going to reassert popery. But at first, she certainly doesn't come right out and say that or do anything openly toward that. But she does something which causes a huge controversy. and that is she celebrated Mass in her house. And you have to understand that during this time, a lot of Romanism is being outlawed, various aspects. And it will be outlawed in its totality by the time we get to the Negative Covenant, or the King's Covenant, or the National Covenant in 1581. But right now, it's not... I'm not sure whether it's yet illegal. I don't think it's legal for her to have a mass going. They, of course, when they do these sorts of things, they want the word to seep out. You know, it's not, if it had been done in total privacy, no one would have known. But they generally do these kinds of things, and they want it to get out. They're sort of testing the water. This is viewed by a lot of people as a harbinger of very bad things to come if this is tolerated. Knox actually says... the thing to be most feared in Scotland, question 59, was one mass. He said he feared one mass more than 10,000 armed enemies landing on any part of the realm. Why do you think he had that sentiment?
Because a little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump.
Yeah. They had purged out the mass by this time to a large extent. And Knox's fear, he says, is related to concern that, you know, if you let back anything you purge, you're inviting an opposition from God, and you're calling down punishment on yourself, your own nation.
It's almost like relapsing into a sin.
Yes.
You should expect worse judgments than before.
Yes. Each relapse into a sin, if God's going to recover you out of it, it'll get worse. If he's going to leave you in it, who knows? All right. In question 60, Shields attributes the blunting of the testimony of ministers against idolatry to what? So there's Knox, and he's saying, hey, bad idea here. We should fear this more than anything. What she's doing is very, very troubling. The problem is that a little time receiving court favors had caused a lot of them to wax cold, and they ceased to testify, or they blunted their testimony against the corruptions of the day. This is always a problem, by the way, with compromise of any kind. You know, a little compromise is going to make you blunt your testimony quite a bit, and a lot of compromise will probably cause you to cease to testify altogether. Yeah.
So this is pretty much the same as like lobbying then? You're receiving favors.
They're receiving court favor. It means that they're getting something from the royal house. They're getting some sort of benefit. And I think it's probably also important to point out they're courting it. In the Book of Esther, Mordecai is going to get a great benefit for himself and his people, but he never courted favor to get it. He's never going to compromise his principles to get it. But they're going to compromise, and they have, and they did. And Shields is saying, look, you know, look what happens when you take a little. Now, there's probably a good reason that he's bringing up this issue here. There's something that was going on in 1687 that he probably associated with this kind of behavior. You know what that might be?
Indulgences?
Indulgences, yeah. So Shields is probably sort of laying the groundwork against accepting of the indulgence. You know, remember, the indulgence is simply, you can join with us, all will be forgiven, you just have to stop testifying against us, particularly in these areas. Right? Don't say bad things. All right, what double battle ensued from this? Question 61. On the one hand, there was fighting against idolatry, which they had to do before. But the other thing that now happened at the Reformation was this. They now had to contend against faithless and false brethren who had blunted their testimony. So prior to that, you know, their situation was okay. We've got, you know, we have to contend for the truth. We have to fight against the idolatry. We've had to do that all along, coming out of popery. But now, with this accepting of court favors, with this blunting of testimony, now we have to contend not only against what we would call the enemies of the truth, but we have to contend against faithless and false brethren, people that we would call erstwhile friends of the truth. Right? They should be. They kind of look like they are. They talk like they are. But in the end, we find out they're not really. They're almost, but they're not quite. Like the almost Christian, right? Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Almost thou persuadest me to be a covenanter. Not quite. But look, if you take the indulgence, you can become an almost covenanter with me. So now they've got to contend against what they've been contending against all along, the idolatry, trying to root that out. But this other faction has arisen of faithless and false brethren. Now, they're at this point, Shields takes up several things in the testimony of the period that he believes confirms heads of the present sufferings that he's going to cover. Okay, so the things that we're talking about, several of these things are of interest to him in particular. Several aspects of that reformation from popery. Because these seven things that we're going to be talking about in their own categories in the second half of the book those things were all very hotly contested in 1687. And Shields is going to say, is saying, actually, look, here we can find precedent for what we're doing at this period for these heads. Not necessarily for every head, but for these heads. So the first one, the first thing that he notes, though, is this. The Reformation, what did the Reformation in Scotland have in common with all other Protestant churches? That is, it was carried out in the face of great opposition. Now, the Reformation did not go peaceably anywhere. The old order didn't die quietly. They had to go in and fight with them, contend with them. Now, this brings us to question 63, Scotland's peculiar advantage in this, the Reformation in Scotland, and that is this. Shields points out Scotland had attained a total reformation in doctrine, government, worship, and discipline. And here's where he quotes Knox as saying, look, we don't have anything in our churches. We've retained nothing that has come from the man of sin. Knox says, no Reformed church has ever achieved the degree of reformation that we have achieved. For degree of purity, for degree of strictness, for degree of faithfulness to the Word of God, nobody has you know, come as close to what Knox would say is the ideal as Scotland.
And that idea sticks around by the time of the Second Reformation, right? Which is why England asked for commissioners from Scotland, because England realizes that Scotland had attained greater reformation than they had.
Yeah, they actually, the other Reformed churches, I think, by and large, were very, at the time, were very deferential and very not eager, but willing, I think, to acknowledge Scotland had achieved a greater, more consistent reformation all the way around. Okay, that's probably going to be the general consensus at that time. Now, believe me, that's not forever, because you can talk to a lot of Dutch Reformed people today who think that Reformed Presbyterians were not ever really even Reformed.
Why?
Not Dutch. And, you know, in Dutch circles, the saying is, if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much. In fact, I remember a talk one time with one of them who told me that you should learn Hebrew to know the language of the Old Testament people, Greek to know the language of the New Testament people, Latin to know the language of the church fathers and the great reformers, and Dutch so you can speak to everyone in heaven. So, anyhow, that was not always that way. It was not that kind of rivalry. And it's not the rivalry that exists now, I think, in some respects, has become unhealthy, and it lacks a certain historical perspective. But part of it, you know, Scotland and the Scots brought on themselves by the severity and the rapidity of their departure that is going on at the time Shields is writing. All right, question 64. According to our author, What practice is worthy of all imitation? He says, what's worthy of all imitation is the purity of zeal of those who've gone before us. In fact, he says, look, and not only did they not comply with or keep peace with the enemies of God, but in fact, they thought it a great sin not to oppose them. When their brethren were forced to take the sword of self-defense, being persuaded by these arguments, and then goes into giving some arguments here. All right. In the course of discussing this, he quotes something from Knox, which I think is a very interesting concept, and that's brought up here in 65. According to Knox, do those who are not the actors in iniquity avoid God's judgment? Knox says this, that if people thought that they were innocent because they were not actors in the iniquity of their day, they were utterly deceived. God doesn't only punish the chief offenders, but also the consenters to such iniquity, and all are judged to consent who do not give testimony against it. So if you're not testifying against the iniquity, Knox is saying you're a consenter and you're under the judgment of God too. Be damned with the rest of them. All right, that's what he's saying. Keeping silence in the face of apostasy is the sin that has brought on every major judgment of God since the flood. He says, look, the old world destroyed by water, Sodom and Jerusalem destroyed. Were they all alike wicked? Of course not. But they all perished, didn't they, when the judgment came? When judgment comes, it doesn't spare those who are seated in silence. Testimony bearing is not optional if you want to avoid the judgment of God. You want to bring the judgment of God on yourself, on your family, on you know, everything you're doing, remain silent while apostasy is going on. That brings us to the next interesting quote that Knox brings up, which is the obligation of lawful magistrates under the gospel. Now, this comes up because there are a lot of people who have complained about the conduct of Knox and the Scottish reformers, especially in their severity against their enemies. They've been accused of having a Jewish rigidity inconsistent with a gospel spirit of lenity. Here's what Knox has to say about that. Whatsoever God required of the civil magistrate in Israel or Judah concerning the observation of true religion during the time of the law, the same does he require of lawful magistrates professing Christ Jesus in the time of the gospel. And then he cites a large testimony out of Augustine to this purpose. So Knox doesn't just stop there. He's clearly saying, look, this is who we are, this is what we're doing. And by the way, probably the greatest early church father, Augustine, is on our side on this. All or the third head that is raised, according to the Confession of 1560, is it lawful to resist superior powers? This is one of these areas where people, I think, just have trouble. They just have a difficult time with this concept. But the Confession of 1560, this is a Scots confession, written by Knox, ratified by the Church of Scotland, adopted by the Parliament. In Article 14, it lists resisting superior powers that are exercising tyranny, that are doing things contrary to the ordinance of God. They say that kind of resistance is lawful and is to be enumerated among the good works of the second table of the law. In other words, if you don't do it, if you go along with tyranny, if you're okay with the oppression of people and destroying the lives of the innocent, if you are okay with any of that, you're in violation of the second table of the law. Now, a lot of people would say, wait a minute, if you resist the powers that be, you know, you're the one who's in violation of the law of God. But the Scots Confession is saying, no, no, when it's tyranny, when it's oppressive, when it's lawless, when it's contrary to the ordinance of God, you are not only warranted, but it's a duty to resist, to do what you can to resist them. It's a good work, according to the second table of law.
I don't know if we'll get into this later, but does that involve, like, what you would call, like, vigilante justice, where if you have an opportunity to kill one of these people as they're coming through your town and no one knows?
Yeah, you're, again, we're going to eventually get to that question.
Okay.
So, Knox, by the way, on this point, he has a number of arguments that that Shields lists from Knox. And this is his first conference with the Queen. Knox is arguing, first of all, there's neither greater honor nor obedience to be given to princes than to parents. But so it is that the father may be stricken with a frenzy in which he would slay his own children. Now, if children arise, take his weapon from him and bind his hands, do the children any wrong? So, you know, if in a natural situation, children can restrain their father until he's, you know, come to his senses or what have you, how much more in a situation that is not so much natural as contractual?
Is that kind of why, like with Charles, didn't the Covenanters kind of give him multiple chances? Is that kind of why, like, they didn't just kill him outright once they transgressed?
Well, they're trying to see if the guy is... first of all, you don't want to just go off and kill someone who's entered into a league and covenant with you. That would be a God-provoking crime on its own. There are a number of things they're trying to press. But second thing he points out in his conference with Lethington, proving the same point, Scripture teaches, he says, Jerusalem and Judah were punished for the sins of Manasseh. If you allege they were punished because they were wicked and not because the king was wicked, Scripture says expressly, for the sins of Manasseh. Yet will I not absolve the people? I will grant the whole people offended with their king. But how? To affirm all Judah committed the acts of his impiety has no certainty. Who can think that all Jerusalem should turn idolaters immediately after Hezekiah's notable reformation? one part thereof willingly followed him in his idolatry, the other suffered him, and so were criminal of his sin, even as Scotland is guilty of the Queen's idolatry this day. So he says, look, if we're not resisting this whole principle, then we're going along with it. The 30 argues from the distinction between person placed in authority and the ordinance of God. Person may be resisted, the ordinance may not. And he gets into the passage in Romans 13 a bit and some other things. Fourth, he argues from examples not only resisting but punishing tyrants, chiefly the example of Uzziah. Is pertinent to his purpose in 2 Chronicles 26, who after usurping the priest's office was put out of the temple.
Are we on question 69?
Mm-hmm.
Are we on question 69?
No.
No, we're still at 67. So these are the various things that he's laying out with regard to resisting the lawfulness of resisting superior powers. This is very much in keeping, by the way, with in 1558, Christopher Goodman, an exiled Scot, wrote a book called How Superior Powers Ought to Be Obeyed. It was a friend of Knox, I suppose. Knox's first blast of the trumpet carries on that theme. Particularly dealing with the issue of women in civil authority. And there are some other things that have come out at and around this time. The French Huguenots were writing on this issue. They'd been thinking about it for a while. I've mentioned in connection with this idea. John Panay, in his treatise on political power, I believe it was 1560, and Junius Brutus's Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants, 1578. Those were Huguenots, French Calvinists, talking about things like tyrannicide. So they're all talking about this. This is not something peculiar, and Shields wants you to understand, this is not some peculiar covenanter view that arises sort of in a corner. You know, the covenanters are the ones who are going to act on this, probably more pointedly than most. But I would say it's only because the covenanters were probably a little bit more courageous. It's not because theoretically they were out of step with all these other people. And by the way, this idea, it's not something which arises only at the time of the Reformation. It gets a lot of discussion then, but this is something which had been in play early on, as Shields points out, in periods 1 and 2, but also there are discussions that are pertinent to what they're doing that occur in some of the more prominent Roman writers in their back and forth with the Protestants on some of these points. You know, they're trying to work out some of these questions themselves. So these points are in debate, they're in flux to some degree, they're in discussion, but a lot of Protestants were mostly where Knox was by the time Knox is telling the Queen and her advisors that we're just simply not going to obey a bunch of papists telling us that we're not allowed to be Protestant. All right. So 68. Does capacity to act make something a duty? This is a question, again, that arises because there's this issue. You know, does something only become a duty if we have the capacity? And the answer is no. A capacity can make nothing a duty which wasn't before. Something can be a duty when we don't have the capacity to carry it out.
Which is the whole point of testimony bearing, right? Mm-hmm. Suffering. We don't have the capacity to change, but we have to still hold to the truth.
Right. Okay. On the other hand, it might make a duty seasonable and give us a call to that duty.
Mm-hmm. And on the same sort of wavelength, just because you have the capacity to do something doesn't necessarily mean that that's a duty.
Correct. Capacity is not a measure of duty. It could be, in the case of a duty, it could be an indication of a seasonable, that duty being seasonably able to be done, or it might give a call to the performance of that duty.
So providence can give a call, sometimes can give a call to duty?
Well, this is an important point that's going to come up. You know, when Shields later on discusses things like the right of private individuals to execute extraordinary judgments in certain cases. Right. But he's dealing with this because of several questions, not least of which is, you know, the queen. You know, just because she has the capacity, can she be a queen? Well, that's one of the questions that they're addressing here. So there's this whole idea. And then when you add to it that this queen is an idolater, it really complicates matters. Right, the last thing that we're going to address in this period, and there's a lot here, and I'm not giving you everything. I'm just trying to survey this. I mean, if I could emphasize anything as we go through the book, is that it's a book worth reading. You should read the book for yourself. There's a lot of material here. I'm just trying to give you sort of an overview and highlights. I'm not able to get into everything. We just don't have the time to do everything. But there's enough here that bears some comment. And pulls together. So the last thing, 69, according to Shields, is it ever lawful and laudable for private persons to execute righteous judgment upon the enemies of God, mankind? The answer is yes. And he gives five conditions, really, when this is certainly the case. The first, when the ruin of the country is at hand. Right. The second is when the destruction of liberty and religion are undertaken. Remember, when he's talking about liberty and religion, he's talking about civil liberty and true liberty of conscience in religious matters. Not pretended liberty of conscience. Right, third, this is when the wrath of God is threatened. The fourth is when destruction, the judgment of God might be averted by destroying those he calls vermin villains. And fifth is when those whose office it is to do this, to execute righteous judgment, decline their duty. Okay. Now, you may or may not recall the story of Archbishop Sharp. But ultimately, when we get to this head of doctrine in the second part of the book, that's really what he's trying to finesse out of this. He wants to get to the question of Archbishop Sharp and whether or not the bishop's death was murder. Here he actually brings up the case of Cardinal Beaton and of the fiddler Rizzio. Rizzio, I didn't mention him, but he talks about him a little bit earlier. Rizzio was Mary, Queen Mary's, calls him the Italian fiddler. He was basically her man whore. And it's complicated because being an Italian meant that he was a papist too. And so they're probably feeling very uptight about the notion that a queen, we already have problems with the queen because she's of French extraction. The next thing and the last thing we need are having the Italians in here too. Okay, they're papists. This is who they are. And we've seen that there's been no movement in these countries, really. And we saw how the French treated the Huguenots. The Reformation didn't even get that far in Italy. Okay, so they're very unhappy about it. It turns out that Cardinal Beaton, who was responsible for the death of George Wissert, who had been one of Knox's early companions when the Reformation was first being promoted. Wissert was one of the earlier martyrs. Beaton presided over that. Beaton himself was later, Knox predicted this, that he would hang from the window where he watched Wissert burn. And later on, he was hanged from that window. Knox didn't think that was a horribly immoral thing to kill the guy after all he had been at the head of persecuting Protestants. And Knox also didn't think it was ridiculously out of line when Rizzio was killed by someone. Because they don't want these kind of people near the throne.
What they would call pests and vermin.
Yeah, so he's saying, you know, these things happened. He gives other cases too. And he's going to give a very lengthy and somewhat reasoned defense on this point when we get to that head of doctrine, which is why I don't want to spend a lot of time. But he's pointing out that even here, at the period of the First Reformation, that period, we already have some precedent for what is going to happen during the killing times when the Covenanters shoot back on some of this stuff. Right. In period 4, next time, we're going to take up the period from 1570, I believe, until the time of the National Covenant. Not in 1581, but in 1638. So this is going to deal with contending against not popery, but prelacy and certain forms of Erastianism. So that's what we're going to talk about next time.